Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Like in the rest of the country, investigating and prosecuting alleged sexual assaults in Wyoming is complicated.
That's one of the biggest frustrations about being in this job is knowing that something occurred and not being able to prove it.
We'll take a look at how budget cuts are affecting suicide prevention efforts in Wyoming, where rates are stable but still high.
If we start seeing that increasing, we'll know that we need to change our strategies and look at other things to be doing.
We'll hear about a new teaching tool being used in Arapahoe, and new methods are being used to keep invasive species from taking over.
We're understanding now a lot more than we used to that, hey, this stuff is a problem.
It's all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. When it comes to sexual assault in the U.S., the majority of victims will not make a report. And Wyoming is not much different than the rest of the country. As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, investigating and prosecuting alleged sexual assaults is complicated.
Albany County Sheriff Dave O'Malley has been involved in sexual assault investigations since 1974. He says he's come across many cases where he knew a rape took place, but he wasn't able to move forward with it.
That's one of the biggest frustrations about being in this job is knowing that something occurred and not being able to prove it.
When it comes to investigating sexual assault, a medical exam oftentimes provides the only physical evidence. However, victims don't always come forward right away, so that evidence isn't always collected. O'Malley adds that the fact intercourse took place isn't always a sign of guilt.
So the presence of semen or something like that during the medical legal examination of a victim really doesn't tell you anything. It just confirms the fact that there was sexual contact.
O'Malley says cases that involve people that are acquaintances or romantically involved are the most difficult ones to prove. He says it becomes a matter of he said, she said, and that's especially true when alcohol or drugs are involved.
That doesn't mean that those are not prosecutable, but you can kind of understand where it might it'd be a much more difficult to convince a jury of 12 that there was an assault beyond a reasonable doubt.
Longtime Sheridan County prosecuting attorney Matt Riedel says in order to take a case to trial, a prosecutor needs to believe there is a reasonable likelihood a conviction will happen. Riedel says that means the evidence needs to be clear and strong.
You can have an insufficiency of evidence to bring the charge, but that doesn't mean that there wasn't a sexual assault. It means that your evidence wasn't sufficient to go forward.
Riedel says he's concerned that some prosecutors and law enforcement may look at insufficient evidence as the same thing as a false report, and that's incorrect. Sheriff O'Malley points out that false reporting of sexual violence is low.
You should know that it's extremely difficult for someone to report that something as unacceptable as themselves or their body being violated. It's just extremely difficult to do. It takes a really strong motivation to make a report in the first place.
But getting a rape conviction is tricky. One of the problems are the myths surrounding rape. As a prosecutor, Riedel has learned that many jurors believe that sexual assaults are perpetrated by a stranger and that there should be a great deal of physical violence that will lead to signs of injury and that victims will report the incident immediately.
That is the way that rape is most often depicted in movies and on TV. We get it into our heads that that's really what a real rape looks like.
Another issue in the courtroom is victim blaming. And Riedel says no other crime invokes as much victim blaming as sexual assault does. Riedel says he thinks some jurors use it as a self-protective mechanism.
What was the mistake that they made that led to them being victimized that I wouldn't have committed and that will make me feel safer?
Riedel says educating jurors is important for convictions, but in order to really address rape culture, education needs to begin out in the community.
Boy, do we need to get out there and educate everybody.
That's Tara Muir with the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. She says people need to better understand what sexual assault looks like. The rapist is usually someone that the victim knows, and that can lead to a delay in reporting. And there are other factors.
Often when a survivor starts disclosing, they're not telling the full story. They're testing the waters. Am I going to get support or am I going to get questioned? Am I going to get blamed? Am I going to end up in the news, depending on who I'm accusing? Those are huge factors.
In an effort to educate, the coalition is currently rolling out pilot projects in Park and Sweetwater County with sexual assault response teams that are made up of law enforcement, prosecutors, victim support services, and other related agencies. Muir says the goal is to improve how sexual assault cases are treated.
Maybe not specifically about individual cases, but how the system works. And get a lot of good education and training on these rape myths and look at the way their system operates so that they see things they do might be perpetuating those myths or not.
Amy Kidd is a sexual assault victim who lives in Casper. She recently complained that her case was neglected, but even she admits there was a time she subscribed to myths surrounding rape.
I think the culture is just so much, well, what were you wearing and how much did you have to drink and why weren't you smarter and you should have made better choices, and it's so easy to victim blame. It's just my eyes were opened in such a way because I finally understood.
The coalition's Muir says they need to get to the point where communities start believing victims rather than just believing offenders. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
In order to manage a $2 million funding cut, the Wyoming Department of Health is scaling back its suicide prevention efforts in counties around the state. Scaling back may be an understatement, since all of the suicide prevention specialists will lose their jobs on July 1st. Wyoming Public Radio's Alana Elder says community prevention officials are concerned about the future.
This is now storage. This was Jake's office. Over here are gun locks.
This is Matt Steck, the community prevention specialist for Teton County. He picks up one of the gun locks that he and a colleague had been distributing around Jackson and stocking in clear plastic cases marked free. The purpose of the locks is to prevent suicides and other gun-related incidents. Steck will be spending less time giving out gun locks since the state legislature eliminated funding for suicide prevention efforts during the last session.
I've been allowed, within reason, some time to facilitate suicide prevention, but my primary focus is going to be alcohol, opioids, and tobacco prevention, and that's where I have an operating budget.
Steck is losing his partner, the community specialist who was focused on suicide prevention in Teton County. He's also losing his office, which is not ideal.
That will create some challenges because I live in a small studio apartment because it's Jackson, Wyoming, and I don't have room for thousands of prevention materials that are in this office.
Steck's colleagues across the state are going through the same kind of thing after the legislature cut funding due to the loss of state revenue. Teresa Humphreys Wadsworth directs suicide operations for the Prevention Management Organization of Wyoming, or PMO, which is in charge of prevention programs in each county. In her last few weeks on the job, Humphreys Wadsworth is frantically trying to document the services that are available in each community, with hopes that the state can still address suicide. She says a new initiative called the Zero Suicide Program, which helps healthcare facilities change their practices to more actively support patients, may help.
Internally, what are their own policies for identifying somebody who's at risk for suicide? Are they screening every patient, or are they waiting for a patient to come in and volunteer that this is something they're struggling with?
Zero Suicide also encourages hospitals and medical centers to follow up with people who they have treated for an attempt or another form of self-injury. In May, PMO sponsored an event called the Zero Suicide Academy to share those guidelines with healthcare organizations from around Wyoming. Matt Steck attended that training, and he is also leading workshops to teach people about postvention, a set of strategies for supporting a community after a suicide has occurred. Steck thinks that the program will be helpful in places like Teton County.
Certain suicides echo across this valley because the people are really connected, and it's tragic. A good postvention response reduces their suffering and then also reduces the risk that there may be more suicides in the community.
The Department of Health's Erica Matthews is looking for grant money for these and other programs. People are concerned that losing local specialists will lead to more suicides. Matthews says measuring success is more complicated than tracking the incidence of suicide, but she thinks Wyoming's rate could be a sign of progress, since it's held stable as national rates have climbed.
Yes, we are double the national suicide rate, pretty much, but we're not increasing. If we start seeing that increasing, we'll know that we need to change our strategies and look at other things to be doing.
Teton County's STEC sees prevention work as a spectrum between making one-on-one connections and advocating for policies. He doesn't know how to measure his impact when he spends hours stapling flyers or delivering gun locks, but he's heard at least once that those efforts helped someone.
We have gotten one report of a gun lock being used in a potential domestic violence situation.
The would-be victim had picked up a free gun lock and checked in with law enforcement to make sure it was positioned correctly.
And then apparently later the person went to access the firearm and was unable to do so. Whether that was for suicide, homicide, or both, we don't know. That's the kind of thing that it makes you go to work.
Even with less money, Steck says that communities will have to continue to work to address the issues that lead to suicide, especially since Wyoming's static rate is still one of the highest in the nation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Alana Elder.
When we come back, some pushback over the state's plan to hunt grizzlies. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. For years now, Fremont County in central Wyoming has been swamped with high waters that have damaged homes and highways every summer. In 2011, the National Guard was even called in to help. But this year was different, even though rivers rose higher than ever before. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Fremont County Emergency Management Coordinator Kathy Metzler and Information Officer Tammy Schroyer to find out what everybody did right this time.
Today, actually, we're doing quite well. The crest of the water was last Saturday, and we had 12.06 here in Riverton. But because of the snowpack this year, we knew quite well we were going to have an exceptional runoff year.
And so it didn't end up turning into quite the emergency that it seemed like it was going to?
Mainly because of all the pre-work and stuff that we did ahead, the wall of Fremont and Lander, the barriers in Hudson, both were protective measures that saved us a lot of problems. Dubois even did fine with doing their early sandbagging and stuff ahead and improved the situation. We didn't understand at that stage that we were going to break a new record, but we knew it wasn't going to be a good season.
Yeah. How many years of flooding has there been, and can you kind of just give us a little history?
In 2010, I had been coordinator for a little less than 2 years at that stage, and we had, it was a snow melt event, which then we ended up with some rain on snow that gave us some more problems. But that affected us, Lander, Hudson, Tribal, mainly the Little Wind side, the south side of the county, and that was a presidential disaster declaration. In 2011, we flooded the north side of the county on the Big Wind, and we got Dubois, Kinnear, Riverton on this side. That was one of our worst nightmares this year, was because of the snowpack, and it runs all the way from Togatee down through South Pass. Were we going to have high water on both rivers this year? Which we did, and we managed to break records in several places, but the biggest momentous one was here on the Big Wind, here just south of Riverton.
And I talked to a meteorologist kind of earlier in the year, and he was saying that, you know, there was just a ton of snow up there, and then there was the concern that all of that snow was going to melt all at once. Mm-hmm. Once it heated up, and that he was hoping that there would be kind of a slow warm-up and that it would melt it off little by little. So what ended up happening?
We basically would have been a week ago from today. It was 95 here. But basically it was the fact that, too, as we get into June, the snow gets riper, as we refer to it, which it becomes more moisture-laden. And it compresses and stuff, so it takes less to actually precipitate that and come down. The key things that can cause you flooding issues are the rain on snow event, or 80, 90 degree days in the basin here 3 days in a row. Those are our trigger points to say, okay, get ready, here she comes. And it was right on schedule. We had good forecasting from National Weather Service. The guys were great to give us our warnings and stuff. The people paid attention, got right out there and did what they could to help things, and we just came through it better this year.
Did you have some problems with people's property getting destroyed or anything like that this year, or was it really just you were able to keep that at bay?
We have a couple homes that are isolated up in the Burris-Lenoir area, but they do have access by a different route than they normally have. And there was the same type of situation out off of Sharp Nose Road, and there they plowed bladed a road out through the sagebrush to get them access back out because we had to close the road where they normally use. But I have not received any calls other than some minimal damage. So we're considering it a very good year.
You know, maybe you could explain kind of why it is that this seems to be happening. Why are these rivers so prone to flooding?
Recently, over the last, at least starting in 2010, we had a lot of citizens that we had to explain to them that this is a normal runoff year. They had been here 10 or 15 years, and we'd been in a drought, so they'd never seen water like this. Since then, it's just been the fact that some places they have infringed a little bit into the areas and built a little up, and that's given us some problems. But we don't have zoning here, and so there's nothing really we can do to control it. We just have to encourage the citizen to take care of themselves.
And so what is it that you're kind of advising people that seems to be working?
Just prepare, monitor the water and stuff, pay attention to the weather forecast. If you can do something like dirt berms or something like that, we encourage the citizens to do that. In 2010, we actually utilized the National Guard to sandbag. We have a policy from the county that only critical infrastructure for the county will be protected by county resources. So you as a citizen and a property owner need to take care of yourself. I would like Tammy to be included here, though, and include
yes.
The safety briefings and whatnot that we've been discussing with people about don't do.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Well, of course, you know, in a disaster, there's no such thing as a textbook disaster. And I would like to echo what Kathy said, that citizens need to be mindful of being able to take care of themselves. You know, be able to read a map and know where you are in relationship to that map so that, you know, you can take the information that is published and sent out and you can assess your own danger or risk. You know, we've talked extensively about not getting into floodwaters, watching your children and your livestock, and make sure that you stay safe from those floodwaters. That's a risk that's not worth taking. And also, be aware that along with people being displaced, like we've had rattlesnakes displaced, and so you need to watch where you're stepping and where your children are going and where your pets are going as you're walking in areas where maybe you've never had a problem with rattlesnakes before. They're homeless right now as well.
Just generally, I would encourage citizens to be prepared. Flood season is not the only time of the year that we have threats to our local communities. We're going to be entering, the cheatgrass is going to dry out. We're going to be in fire season here shortly. And We're still using, at least in Fremont County, I'm still using the Ready, Set, Go as far as our evacuation plan that we have had up on the county website for the last month now. So, or if you didn't get a chance to see it there, contact the office. We'd be happy to give you any information on that or answer your questions.
All right. Well, thank you guys both for taking time to talk to me.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Fremont County Emergency Management Coordinator Kathy Metzler and Information Officer Tammy Schroyer, talking about record-breaking runoff in the Little and Big Wind Rivers.
Grizzly bears may be taken off the endangered species list soon, and hunts are part of Wyoming's bear management plans. Those planned hunts are drawing fire from tribes, the Sierra Club, and comments from Yellowstone National Park. Penny Preston reports.
For 40-plus years, the only people who have hunted grizzlies here are tourists and photographers. They come from around the world, hoping for a glimpse of the country's largest and most powerful carnivore. Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wink revealed the results of a park survey at a Cody luncheon.
Why do visitors come? Top reason is to view wildlife.
After the luncheon, Wink explained.
Wolves, bears, bison, elk, I mean, it really is, it is wildlife. It's one of the greatest wildlife displays, certainly in the United States, certainly the lower 48, and people recognize that and they come.
But in the early 70s, there weren't many grizzlies to see in Yellowstone and no wolves. There were only 136 grizzly bears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem in 1975 when the species was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. The grizzly was delisted in 2007 before a 2009 court ruling put them back under federal protection. After a review, the federal government proposed delisting again last year. Wyoming's Game and Fish Regional Wildlife Supervisor, Alan Osterland, is based in Park County, and he says they are ready to take over management of the bear. Part of that management will be grizzly hunts.
That's our management tool is hunting. So we propose a season which would go out to public comment and then ultimately would have to be ratified by the commission.
Yellowstone Superintendent Wink says he'd like to see the hunting to be focused on problem bears. Osterland says Game and Fish is not willing to go that far.
Whether it's a black bear or a big game animal, we always try to use hunting to mitigate that problem. I anticipate that might be some of the same process that we'll use if we're hunting grizzly bears. However, the department doesn't feel that it's our place to be telling a hunter where they can go, which bear they can shoot.
Osterland pointed out the state of Wyoming has spent $40 million to help recover the bear. He says some hunters will want a backcountry experience. But Sierra Club spokeswoman Bonnie Rice says there shouldn't be any hunts at all, mainly because they aren't needed. She points to official estimates that grizzly numbers are declining from a high estimate of 750 bears to 690 last year.
And we think that has a lot to do with the decline in food sources because of climate change that grizzly bears in the Yellowstone region are facing and record high mortalities that are related to bears seeking other food sources coming into closer contact with, for example, hunters.
Billboards for and against delisting have appeared in Cody for a year now. One says wolf, grizz, delist, hunt. The newest billboard says, want to see bears? Say no to trophy hunting. A tribal group put up a billboard last year that said, why? Yellowstone's grizzlies are not trophies. Rice says that is an issue that should be considered.
There are over 120 tribal nations that have signed a treaty against delisting. Tribes have been calling for consultation with the U.S. government on delisting of the Yellowstone grizzly bear population, and that has not happened yet.
Game and Fish officials say they are preparing for delisting soon. From grizzly bear country, from Cody to Bozeman, Penny Preston for Wyoming Public Radio.
Coming up on the show, Congress talks infrastructure and a new teaching tool in Arapaho. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. You may have missed it, but President Donald Trump dubbed last week Infrastructure Week. So we had our congressional correspondent Matt Laszlo check in with our lawmakers in Washington to see how the effort is going to pass Trump's hoped-for $1 trillion infrastructure bill. Here's his report.
President Trump desperately wants a major legislative victory, which is why he held a Rose Garden ceremony with House Republicans after only their chamber passed an overhaul of Obamacare, a bill he later told Republican senators was mean. But Trump and his agenda remain bogged down by the Russia investigation, and he keeps distracting Congress with tweets that Republican leaders have tried to get him to stop sending out. Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney says Trump needs to rise above.
You know, I mean, I've seen this through several administrations, and it is always a challenge in Washington. You know, it's a place where, you know, often the stuff that is sort of most exciting to the media isn't the actual, you know, hard work of the policy changes that have got to be made.
That's why Cheney is still hopeful Congress can send this freshman president a massive infrastructure bill this year.
I think that, you know, our task as members of Congress is to just keep our eye on the ball in terms of the change that's needed for the people of the country and for the people of Wyoming, and not let sort of the background noise and the media coverage of a lot of the scandal, so-called scandal, take over.
As for the president's plan, Cheney says she can't support something that is void of details.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we haven't seen a proposal yet, and so it'll depend on what's in the proposal. It'll depend on how the funding is set up. So, you know, it's impossible to say, yes, this will pass or no, it won't, until we actually see what a bill looks like.
Cheney does say she wants coastal states to pony up more money than rural states because she says trucks traveling from the Southwest or California use Wyoming highways.
But certainly if you look at something like I-80, I think that the wear and tear in Wyoming is certainly not just from Wyoming folks, Wyoming vehicles. And so we ought to make sure we're finding ways that that we don't have to bear the brunt of that.
On the other side of the aisle, Democrats have produced infrastructure plans that have flesh on the bones. Senate Democrats released a proposal early in this Congress, and more recently, progressives dropped their own $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison, a vice chair of the DNC, says Trump's recently released budget reveals he's abandoned his base when it comes to his promise to create jobs and support rural America.
The president's budget just represents a complete abandonment of working America. It's a turning of his back on them. And, you know, he went to them and sold them jobs, infrastructure, and fair trade. And what he's given them is a literal devastation of social safety net program.
Republicans see it much differently, but when it comes to infrastructure, major hurdles remain for the GOP. Still, Wyoming Junior Senator John Barrasso remains optimistic, and he chairs the Senate's Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, so he's got a seat at the head table.
We're working with the White House on this. I'm working with the Democrats, continue to work with them. It's a bipartisan effort. The president's focused on that as well. So, yeah, we need to get this done. It's an important part of the components that the country needs. There are roads, bridges, dams all around the country that need work.
One of the biggest hurdles facing the GOP is how to pay for a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. The president wants a private-public partnership to pay for it, but rural lawmakers say that won't work out west. Barrasso says that's a concern.
Well, you need to do basically a menu of different options to pay for different parts of it. These private-public partnerships work very well in big cities and in the Rocky Mountain West. Even, you know, you look at I-470 around Denver, I mean, that works well. And because you still have a bigger population. But in Wyoming, that's not going to work well.
Barrasso has allies in his effort to derail the public-private partnership proposal to pay for the bulk of a new infrastructure plan, because there are many rural lawmakers on his powerful committee.
There's all this money overseas, trillions of dollars that I want to get using repatriation, bring that money back that can then be used for infrastructure projects. I think we ought to be eliminating some unnecessary programs. You can use some of that money for rural America. You know, a position that I believe that our committee is going to have, just based on the makeup of the committee, is funding with government involvement.
The president is still pushing the Senate to pass a health care overhaul as soon as possible, and he wants a massive tax reform package passed, which is why critics are starting to doubt he can also get a huge infrastructure package through this Congress. Wyoming lawmakers remain optimistic, though they're still waiting on those pesky little details. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Turning to education, on the Wind River Reservation, students are learning how to use futuristic tools to stretch the bounds of what's possible in the classroom. Rebecca Huntington has more.
What if you could put a swimming pool in the middle of your classroom? That's just what students at the Arapahoe Elementary School couldn't wait to do.
Let's be careful and not stand on the swimming pool. So now we're going to push select.
And I think we probably want a really big swimming pool so everybody can fit in it, right?
Although it's not real, the excitement is audible as teachers use augmented reality to superimpose a swimming pool on the classroom floor.
Just wait, you're all going to be in it.
Whoa! You guys are all in the
The demonstration is being led by Zanka, an augmented reality artist from Los Angeles.
My name is Jenny Carden. I use Zanka as my artist name, and that's what most people call me.
Zanka's serving as a futurist in residence for Jackson Hole Wild, a nonprofit organization that presents films, speakers, and interactive events about science and nature. J.H. Wild brought Zanka to the Arapaho schools, where she's teaching students the difference between augmented and virtual reality.
Augmented reality is where you take a virtual object and you place it in the real world. Virtual reality is where you block out your vision. So we're not in this room anymore. We're, you know, inside a movie, for example. So one can sort of transport you somewhere else, and one mixes those two worlds together.
And that makes it possible to bring, well, just about anything you want into the classroom. Teaching science, how about a little virtual dinosaur show and tell? Augmented reality can be tailored to the unique needs of each school. Here, for example, it could be used to teach the Arapaho language.
You know, you can imagine them taking the idea of Pokemon Go, which is an augmented reality game, and putting that into their school, where they hide objects that then reveal the word in Arapaho once they find it. So this is a way to make learning engaging, because humans learn by playing. And if you don't make education fun, it's hard for kids to grab onto the knowledge.
Norma Horseman, the Arapaho art teacher for grades K through 12, helped design the project with J.H. Wild. She says she's learning as much as the students are.
Virtual reality and augmented reality is all new to me. So going forward, I see all kinds of applications. We can use it with art and collaborating with other subjects in school, the culture, the language, science, social studies, writing.
Do you think the kids enjoyed working with augmented reality?
I think the kids really enjoyed it. It's part of their future and it's part of their present.
Horseman says the older students used augmented reality to create self-portraits.
Sixth grade took selfies, eighth grade I took the portraits, and then they changed them to tell and reveal different aspects of their lives or personalities. I found that really interesting because as long as I've had some of these kids in class, I still found out some things about them that I didn't know.
Zanka demonstrates. She opens a binder to a printed picture of a boy in front of a plain backdrop. Then she hovers her cell phone over the photo, and an app reveals hidden images.
When you look at the overlay, he's got a circle showing clouds going into rain, and then he's got a ton of books behind him. It's his bookshelf from home. He's telling us all the books that he's read.
Zanka says she hopes students will continue to play with augmented reality once she's gone.
It's important when we have these new revolutionary concepts to explore them, to get our hands dirty, and to understand what can we do with this technology? Because what a 14-year-old Arapaho girl does with it is going to be different than what I do with it in Los Angeles.
Embracing augmented reality, she says, gives students the power to design a future that reflects their own interests and ideas. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
So what do parents think about Wyoming's K-12 education system? At a time when the state is adopting new guidelines laid out by federal Every Student Succeeds Act and policymakers are considering major funding cuts, Sheila McGuire, the president of the Wyoming Parent Teacher Association, spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson about why the parent voice is so critical.
I think it's a really crucial time right now. Both statewide and nationally, we know most anybody who's paying attention knows how much of a shortfall Wyoming schools are facing. And I think we all need to be very active and speak up about our concerns and how we think the state should proceed and deal with this. Legislators everywhere need to hear from parents, and we have a lot more strength when we're concerted, and there are many of us instead of just one voice.
And what does the PTA look like across the state right now? How many communities have active chapters?
So not very many, really. We kind of have pockets of PTA participation. We have a few schools in Evanston, and then Casper and Laramie and Cheyenne. So active PTAs, we just have those four pockets throughout the state. We end up getting a lot of organizations that say, oh, I have a PTA. They really don't. They have a PTO.
So what is the difference between a parent-teacher association, known as a PTA, and a parent-teacher organization, a PTO?
So PTAs are affiliated with the state PTA and all affiliated with each other and affiliated with the national PTA. So PTAs have legislative and advocacy wings that focus on providing stuff for kids everywhere, whereas PTOs are just parent groups that can spring up pretty much wherever and mostly just providing events at that one school.
And so what has been the big focus of the Wyoming PTA over the last couple years?
Actually, about 4 years ago, we had no Wyoming State PTA. Nobody had stepped up to run it, and it was defunct. So the last few years have really been us focusing on trying to establish PTA again in a state where it was pretty much dead.
And tell me, why have you worked so hard to bring it back?
Parent participation is really, really key at a school-wide level, at a district level. It's really, really important to hear from parents. Lots of times their input seems to get buried under administrator input or educator input or whatever, and people don't really look at stuff as much from a parent perspective. When you're able to communicate with each other and band together, several parent voices or hundreds of parent voices have a bigger impact than just one. So all of us banding together to say, we want to support every student succeeds, or we want to support non-discrimination policies, or we want to support maximum education funding. All of these concerted voices have a lot bigger impact than just one person. And so I think it's just really crucial to have parents involved in what goes on at our kids' schools. My kids spend more time a day at school than they do with me most of the time. So what goes on there matters. And I think just bringing more voices to the table and having people share ideas, share concerns, share interests, A, it makes you feel not so alone in your concerns when you feel like, I'm just one parent, what can I do? But when you understand that other people have the same concerns and the same issues, it gives you this sense of, I'm not alone, so maybe we can address this. Maybe this isn't as out of reach as I thought maybe it was.
All right, so a PTA theoretically connects parents across the state. Can you give me an example of what PTAs do for individual schools?
Yeah, so we have one school in Evanston that has been PTA for a long time. That school participated in National PTA School of Excellence program, which is at the beginning of the school year. You send out a survey with parents asking them questions like, do you feel welcome at this school? Do you feel welcome at PTA meetings? Is there anything we could do? We take all those answers and then work on them throughout the year and then give the same survey at the end of the school year and look for improvement, look for other things we need to work on. Simply trying to do that and reaching out to more parents has made us aware of other issues that maybe we weren't aware of. It focuses on stuff like, are you sending notes home in Spanish if you have a Spanish-speaking community? Are you reaching out to both parents in households where the parents are divorced or no longer live together? Are you taking consideration of kids who maybe live with their grandparents? These are all things that PTA focuses on because they recognize that not every family is the same. And you have to be ready to meet people in different ways. So just being able to do that and focus on all of these things, here in Evanston anyway, parents are paying more attention. They're going to school board meetings more often. They're volunteering a lot. They're helping out with things. And it, you know, is maybe different parents than would have been otherwise if they hadn't been asked to get involved.
That was Sheila McGuire, president of the Wyoming Parent Teacher Association. The organization saw the highest percentage of member growth of any state this year, and the Wyoming PTA will be rewarded for their efforts on June 24th at the National Parent Teacher Association Convention in Las Vegas. When we come back, a look at the problems with invasive species. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming is considering new ways to manage its invasive species. Weeds like cheatgrass and toad flax can replace valuable forage area and sagebrush, hurting species that rely on them. In fact, non-native species are considered the second greatest threat to biodiversity. Though Wyoming does invest heavily in controlling it, experts find it isn't enough. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports both state and federal agencies are working to find more effective strategies.
Near Medicine Bow Forest, there's a scenic road that cuts in between a valley. The north face is shaded, covered with small flowers, trees, and dark green plant life, edible to deer and small animals. The south face, on the other hand.
You see over here on this slope, you see nothing but rocks and cheatgrass. Not a lot of animals are going to hang out in there.
Lindsay Wheat is with the Albany County Weed and Pest Council. She says the ecosystem is ruined on this side of the valley. It would look like the North Slope if not for the cheatgrass killing off native plant species and ruining the soil quality. It's a thin, foot-tall grass originally brought to the States as packing material. It's also the most widespread weed in Wyoming. Wheat says it can take over people's yards.
If they get a little patch, it starts spreading on them, and then it can take over and end up looking like invaded the whole hillside.
But that's just one of 26 noxious weeds in state that become more pervasive with each passing year. According to the National Wildlife Federation, invasive species are the second largest threat to biodiversity after habitat destruction. 42% of endangered and threatened species are at risk due to invasives as well. For example, cheatgrass damages sagegrass habitat by replacing sagebrush.
One fire in Idaho that obliterated the breeding habitat for sage grouse on more than 200,000 acres in one fire, and that was cheatgrass based.
That's Brian Rutledge, vice president of the Audubon Society. He says invasives are so dangerous to native wildlife because they aren't equal competition. They often have no predators to limit their population. They can also change the balance of the ecosystem by stealing resources from more vulnerable plants and animals. University of Wyoming ecologist Dan Tekela says the state does invest in invasive species control, more than $17 million per year. There's even a statewide weed management association. The acreage of invasive species just keeps growing. Tekela says he's concerned control efforts are too reactive.
Right, you don't respond to the invasion until there's 1,000 acres and it's very obvious something went wrong. And by that point, it's too late. You're never going to eradicate a 1,000-acre invasion, 100-acre invasion, in fact, you're never going to eradicate.
Tekela says he would like to see more investment in early detection, rapid response, or EDRR. The state wildlife action plan this year called for a several million-dollar investment in this method.
Prevention is the best cure for invasive plants. So you want to have eyes on the ground looking for those species and then respond to them very quickly.
Agencies in Wyoming have also started to work together across state, Forest Service, or private lines. Something called coordinated resource management brings together relevant organizations to pool funding and choose long-term goals to collaboratively remove non-native species. Tekela adds there needs to be creative approaches to taking out established invasions. Showering cheatgrass with herbicide only goes so far. He says he and a colleague are experimenting with a new strategy.
Working on a project where we're integrating grazing of sheep with herbicide to try to see, can we reduce the amount of herbicide by grazing, but also get effective control.
Congress agrees there needs to be a more creative approach. The Wild Act, officially called the Wildlife Innovation and Longevity Driver Act, has been sponsored by U.S. Senator John Barrasso. If passed into law, the act would start a competition searching for new technology to improve invasive species management. Jamie Reeser is head of the National Invasive Species Council. She recently testified there are plenty of better management technologies that exist. They just need funding. Take cheatgrass.
Opportunities for reducing the spread and impact of cheatgrass in western rangelands are being improved through a combination of surveillance and mapping technologies, as well as biocontrol, chemical control, and genetic engineering, for example, to reduce herbicide resistance.
In English, new technology could spot and prevent early instances of cheatgrass before it gets out of hand. Other existing technologies include a DNA-based surveillance that could track early invasions. There's also a fungus that could target one plant while avoiding another. Many wildlife advocates in Wyoming say they're pleased just to see national acknowledgement of such an often ignored threat to vulnerable wildlife. Back near Medicine Bow, Lindsay Wheat stands by the road.
I think that recognition is there. You know, finally they're saying, hey, you know, we need to step up and do something and be a better neighbor than what we have been, maybe.
She looks up towards the steep, rocky slope covered in cheatgrass.
We're understanding now a lot more than we used to that, hey, this stuff is a problem.
Two new weed species have recently been found in small patches in Sheridan County. Federal and state ecologists say new methods might keep it from ever becoming a real issue. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
A new book focused on the people who live and work in Yellowstone is out, called People of Yellowstone. It features wonderful photography by Steve Horan with prose by Ruth Crocker. Horan says the idea was pitched to him.
So it wasn't hard to locate them and pinpoint who I was going to photograph, but it was hard to convince them to get into front of the camera and expose their lives to something that will put a spotlight on their lives.
I find it interesting that there were so many different people involved in Yellowstone. Boy, you have a reverend in there. You've got people that have all kinds of different jobs. How did you find them all?
Through the internet or through conversations, people that met me, I would, in the next 2 minutes, I would be talking about the people of Yellowstone to see if I could get somebody in front, a friend of theirs. But the main recruiting for the project was through the people that I photographed. And then I asked them, after the session, they felt comfortable with that, recommending somebody to me.
Now, Ruth, my understanding is you came along a little bit after Steve started this project. How did you get involved in this?
Well, my brother is a ranger in Yellowstone, and he was being photographed by Steve. And at the time, I think Steve was about 4 years into the project, and he had a writer, but she had quit, and so he was complaining to my brother, and my brother said, well, my sister's a writer. Why don't you call her up?
And then you came out, and I guess you had to go back and interview all the people he took pictures of?
You know, eventually. It took about 3 years to track everyone down, get their interview, write the interview, and then send it to them so they could take a look at it and fact check things.
Steve, what did this take, about 5-6 years to get this thing done?
You know, I was so naive in the beginning when I came out here in 2010 that I thought people would want to be in the project, but that was not the case. I had to convince the people to be there, so it was 5 years. I thought it was going to be a year and a half, but 5 years of commuting from Florida, 2,400 miles, to get here and then stay here for 5 or 6 months to track people down, have meetings, talk what we wanted to do, collaborate with them, then scout the location, and then have the shoot, and then edit. And it was a huge amount of work, but it was something I'm passionate about. Every time I talked to somebody, I learned something new. And that was what inspired me. And people told me how they changed their lives to be here. And that was amazing. And my brother is certainly a template for that. He came after college and he saw the wilds of the West and he says, he's got to come out here. And he did.
You know,
he changed his life for this place.
Well, and I think that's a very interesting point. I wanted to ask both of you about that, but I'll start with you, Steve. You know, that seems to be the, and I saw a pre-interview comment about this, but it seems to be the one thing that everybody had in common. The outdoors, were they different than people maybe you've run into before?
It's nice to be connected to nature and understand it. And I think that's the common denominator throughout this book and through the people in Wyoming, people in Montana, out west, because they see what can happen. They're connected. They're right there. They have moose coming out by their house.
In fact, I've felt that myself. I've been staying in West Yellowstone and driving to Old Faithful, where we've had a book signing for a week. And, you know, this landscape and this place is so powerful. And the other part of it is that it's a very special community of people who become connected together. You think, you know, these are all, you know, people who want to be away from people, but That's not true.
Well, it's a fabulous book. It's photos of the people of Yellowstone, some narrative written by Ruth Crocker. Steve Horan did the photography, and it is available right now. I want to thank both of you for joining us on the program, and good luck with this. Steve and Ruth, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. You take care.
Horan will post a presentation at the Draper Museum in Cody on June 23rd, and you can get the book at peopleofyellowstone.com. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed any part of the show or want to hear it or an individual segment again, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We also invite you to submit story ideas for future programs and to follow all of our reporters on Twitter and Instagram.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.